Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Hello to you, the listener. I'm Gail Seiler, your host for today. Thanks for tuning in. On the show, we will be talking with Dustin Ingram from the Chamber of Commerce about keeping small towns in Story County growing and going strong. We'll also have an interview with the owner of two Abelardos restaurants here in Ames and Ankeny, and we'll hear about this family-owned business and how it came to be. So stay tuned for all of that. I want to remind our listeners that we are wrapping up our membership drive, so we are asking you to consider all that Local Talk and KHOI provide to you and to the community. The people stories, the animal stories, the funny and the sad, the news and the music. If you value all of that, or any of that, frankly, now is the time to step up and become a member. Basic membership is $55, and the easiest way to donate is to go to the website khoifm.org and click the donate button on the left-hand side. It is quick and safe and secure. And once you do that, you can proudly say you are part of the KHOI family. The weather over the weekend was warmer and sunnier than it has been, and it looks like that will continue at least for part of the week. Today will be sunny with a high of 45 degrees. Tuesday and Wednesday, the highs will also be around 45, but with more clouds both days and some rain on Wednesday. Thursday through Saturday, the high temperatures will be in the 30s, but it will stay above freezing during the daytime, going into the 20s at night. Then on Sunday, the temperature will dip down to a high of 32 again. So as we are getting close to the holiday of Christmas, it does not look too promising that we will have a white Christmas. But let's keep our fingers crossed and hope for snow. At least that's what I'm wishing for. Now let's go ahead and start today's show with the news from Dennis Hart.
Thanks very much, Gail. It's good to be back here on this week before Christmas. Let's start our news rundown with word from the world of politics last week when the Des Moines Register released a new Iowa poll about possible Democratic Party hopefuls in the 2020 state caucuses. And that poll showed that Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders topped the list preferred by Iowa's likely Democratic caucus goers. Former Vice President and Senator Biden was the choice of 32% of respondents, while Senator Sanders was the choice of 19%. Congressman Beto O'Rourke of Texas earned the support of 11% of those who responded. Also last week, Iowa Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley said he doubted whether President Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, could implicate the president in any wrongdoing, given what Grassley said was Cohen's inability to tell the truth. Cohen was sentenced last week to 3 years in prison for crimes that included arranging the payment of hush money to two women, which Cohen said he paid at the direction of the president. Still on the political beat, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds and Republican legislative leaders hinted last week at making additional changes to Iowa's tax code. Neither offered specifics, but the governor is expected to do so next month during her condition of the state address on January 15th. Also last week, the governor said she's open to changing the nonpartisan way that a commission recommends filling vacancies to the state Supreme Court. Iowa's current system of filling vacancies to the state's highest court and to the Court of Appeals involves the Iowa Judicial Nominating Commission, a 17-member group that interviews applicants for the vacancies, selects finalists, and then submits those names to the governor. Also last week, state budget experts said revenue projections for the current fiscal year are running slightly ahead of their October projections, but that growth for the 2020 budget is expected to be lower. The three-member revenue estimating conference said state income is up nearly 5% from the previous year, but the group said only a 1.7% increase in revenue is anticipated next year. Meanwhile, last week, Iowa Democratic State Senator Nate Bolton asked a Senate Ethics Committee to dismiss a sexual misconduct complaint filed against him last month. Bolton said it was beyond the committee's scope to look into his behavior before he was elected. Bolton was elected in 2016. A Des Moines attorney has alleged that he inappropriately grabbed her several times at a Des Moines bar in 2015. And one more political note, this one from Washington, D.C., where Iowa Republican U.S. Senator Joni Ernst hosted an Iowa State Fair-themed lunch at the Capitol on Thursday. On the menu, hot beef sundaes, pork chops, loaded tater tots on a stick, and many butter cows with bread rolls. There were a number of stories last week involving schools. In Waukee, felony charges were filed against the chief operating officer of the Waukee School District. Eric Rose surrendered at the Dallas County Jail early Saturday morning. He was charged with two counts of soliciting a felony and one count of felonious misconduct in office. If he's convicted, he faces up to 5 years in prison. This after a state audit revealed that Waukee school administrators improperly used district charge cards, spent large sums of money on out-of-state retreats, and violated district policies without consequences. In Marshalltown, a state audit found more than $645,000 worth of improper disbursements and deposited collections by the Marshalltown Community School District. That audit came after the discovery of tax payments being late for the past 11 months. Included in the audit's findings, $616,000 of penalties and interest to the IRS, Iowa Workforce Development, the Iowa Department of Revenue, and to IPERS. The Marshalltown School District serves about 4,900 students. In Marion, a student was taken into custody after threatening to use a firearm inside a school. Marion police received the report of the threat at the Vernon Middle School on Tuesday, and the school was put on lockdown. No one was hurt and no weapon was found, but the child who made the threat was charged with first-degree harassment and transferred to Linn County Juvenile Detention Center. Meanwhile, a video was released of a Fort Madison school principal who had been disciplined for dressing in a banana costume and allegedly asking a female student to hold his banana. The incident involved Fort Madison Middle School principal Todd Dirth and took place last year during a school assembly. Dirth remains as the school's principal. He was disciplined as a result of the incident, but the district won't say how. At the University of Iowa, details were released about what some fraternities did that got them banned or placed on suspension in recent months. In one case, underage pledges were asked to drink their way through cases of beer and hard liquor. In another case, pledges were assaulted with body slams if they dropped a book. And at Grinnell College, students ended the expansion efforts of a union representing student workers because they worried that rejection of their request would harm other student unions. There was news outside the world of education last week, including word that an Iowa inmate died of unknown causes while he was in custody. 52-year-old inmate Paul Cassell had been serving a 25-year sentence for attempted murder. In Des Moines, a man's body was pulled out of the Des Moines River on Saturday, about 3 hours after he was seen wading in the water. Witnesses had reported seeing a man in the water just north of the Grand Avenue Bridge. Hours later, the body was found near where the man was last seen. Meanwhile, Urbandale police said a 20-year-old man accidentally shot and killed himself. Anthony Ryan Taylor was at a friend's house when the shooting occurred. In South Central Iowa, authorities were investigating a fatal hunting accident last week. Marion County deputies and Iowa Natural Resources Department officials responded to a report of the shooting at Roberts Creek Park on the north side of Lake Red Rock. 23-year-old Blake Schroeder had been struck by a round apparently fired by a member of his hunting party. Also last week, a Marshalltown man died in a single-vehicle accident in Marshall County. 22-year-old Chase Ellen Clark was driving eastbound on Highway 30 west of Marshalltown on Tuesday when, for an unknown reason, his vehicle entered the median, re-entered the highway, and then went into a ditch and rolled. Clark was ejected from the vehicle. Meanwhile, a Central Iowa man was arrested last week on suspicion of causing the death of a Colfax man during an August drag racing crash in Ankeny. 21-year-old Brandon Joseph Farron of Johnston was charged with homicide by vehicle. There was more last week, including word that for the second time in 3 months, the Clark County prosecutor was arrested. 42-year-old Clark County attorney Michelle Rivera was arrested on Friday on suspicion of operating a vehicle while intoxicated. Back in October, she was arrested on suspicion of being drunk on the job in a Clark County courtroom. She apologized and asked voters to give her another chance, but she lost her bid for re-election last month. Meanwhile, a Des Moines man was sentenced to 40 years in prison for producing child pornography. 33-year-old Wayne Eugene Hall had pleaded guilty to manufacturing and possessing child pornography. Also last week, a Des Moines mom who had pleaded guilty to child endangerment after giving her 6-month-old son large amounts of Benadryl before he died was sentenced to probation for 2 years. 34-year-old Latia Johnson was arrested last April. She admitted giving her son 2 10-milliliter doses of Benadryl. Police said the average dose for a child weighing between 11 and 16 pounds is 2.5 milliliters. Meanwhile, a Waukee mother of three was sentenced to 30 years behind bars after she stole from several employers in the Des Moines metro area. 30-year-old Priscilla Hieronymus had pleaded guilty to 7 felonies, including forgery, fraudulent practices, identity theft, and credit card fraud. Also last week, if you happened to be driving northbound on Interstate 35 near Ankeny on Monday and noticed one of the northbound lanes and an on-ramp were closed, here's why. A repair crew was on the scene investigating and fixing a pavement failure that resulted in a big pothole. Also last week, word that Iowa lottery players could have the option of buying electronic tickets while using mobile phone apps as long as they don't buy with credit cards. All this part of a proposal from state officials to the Iowa legislature. The lottery had a record $371 million in sales last year, but players apparently want more convenience and cashless choices in the future. A plan to give them what they want is being drafted into a bill for consideration in next year's state legislative session. There was word last week that the blank IMAX Dome Theater at the Science Center of Iowa in Des Moines is still months away from reopening, more than 5 months after sustaining flood damage. Two storms hit the Science Center within a week last June, flooding the theater at the same time they flooded homes across central Iowa. Iowa State University football fans got some good news last week, with news that coach Matt Campbell had agreed to a contract extension through the year 2024. Meanwhile, thrill seekers also received some good news, with word of a new roller coaster they can look forward to next summer at Adventureland in Altoona. A spinning coaster called The Phoenix will open in June, featuring a four-seat car that spins 360 degrees as it goes up and down hills. The new roller coaster will cost $6 million, and it will replace the Inverter, a ride that was discontinued last year. A spokeswoman for Adventureland calls the new coaster a whole new degree of craziness. In the category of strange stories last week, there was one about two so-called porch pirates who were arrested for allegedly swiping packages from two West Des Moines homes. And there was another one about the Olwine man who said his zebra was shot and killed. What makes this one even stranger is that it was the man's fourth zebra that was killed in the past year. And that is your summary of the week's important and interesting and unusual news from around Iowa. I'm Dennis Hart, reminding you that I'll be right back here on Friday with a look at the week's news from Ames. In the meantime, I hope you have a really great week before Christmas.
Thanks to Dennis for that news update. And the song you just heard was Skating by the Vince Guaraldi Sextet. And that version of it was from the movie A Boy Named Charlie Brown. I heard over the weekend that Merriam-Webster Dictionary always chooses a word of the year. And this year, the word they chose as the word of the year is justice, because there was a 74% spike in lookups of that word online. There's something for us all to think about today. You may have seen Abelardo's Mexican restaurants in your travels in Iowa. There are several of them. In particular, we had heard about the Abelardo's in Ames, and the word was that they serve a wide variety of Mexican food that is all freshly made. So we wanted to check it out to see what was going on with that homemade Mexican food served in the former Long John Silver building on Lincoln Way. Ursula and I had lunch there, and then I sat down with Eleazar Flores, who is the owner. Eleazar and his brother Cesar are the owners of two Abelardo's restaurants, one in Ames and one in Ankeny. We're sitting here in the restaurant, the Abelardo's on Lincoln Way in Ames. For our listeners who can't see this place, can you describe it to us?
Yes, the building used to be a Long John Silver's. We're trying to make a little improvement in the interior. We're changing the boots to make it a little cozier, make it go more with our theme. And the restaurant's pretty big. We have two lobbies where customers have more than enough space to sit. It's not too crowded. And we also have our little salsa bar, which is it's really great. We have a big variety of hot sauce. We have six in total. And customers can just come in, choose their hot sauce, serve as much as they want, and enjoy their burritos.
And you also have some, like, pickles and other condiments there as well, right?
Correct. We have the pickled carrots, and we have jalapenos. We also have lime out there for the customers.
The decor is white walls, but with lots of red and green trim. Why did you choose those colors?
Those represent the colors of the Mexican flag. We wanted to go with that theme, especially because it's the Abelardo's theme as well. Those are our colors, red, white, and green.
And the Abelardo's in Ankeny, you said, is also in a former Long John Silver's.
That is correct, yes.
So does it look kind of similar?
Yeah, we made several changes in our Ankeny location. Our booths are a different color than they used to be now. They're red. They go with the theme. It's a lot smaller than the Ames location. We are trying to work on the exterior. It's a little run down right now, but we're going to start remodeling here in a couple months, where it's going to look a lot better, just have a better representation of what we are.
How long have you had these restaurants?
I started with the Ankeny location in August of 2015. After that, we opened the Ames location, or this location, in about 8 months after we opened our Ankeny location. So, yeah, we've been here since 2015.
And tell us how Abelardo's works.
It's a small chain. They started out in Omaha, and I and my brother used to work for them when they had barely started, and this was about 10 years ago. Soon the owner started opening more locations where he couldn't manage all of them, and he made it into a small franchise, but it was handed down to the former employees. So most of the Abelardos are owned by employees.
So it gives people an opportunity who had been working there to actually become owners of one.
That is correct. I actually worked for Abelardo's before buying into the franchise in 2013.
Is the menu the same at all Abelardo's, or do you make it your own?
The menu is the same in all the Abelardo's, but we have the freedom to change small things or add things, depending on what the customer has asked for.
I had the pleasure of enjoying a little bit of lunch here, especially the tamale, which was very, very delicious. So you make all the food fresh right here?
That is correct. Everything's made from scratch. The tamales are made by the manager, which is my sister-in-law. We work as a family together to make everything run a lot better and keep it homemade.
Are there other things that you would consider your specialty that are particularly good that people should try?
We make the carnitas, the shredded pork. Those are really good. We make them homemade style. And, I mean, our chimichangas are really popular. Those are well-known as well.
And the carnitas you can get in a taco or in a burrito or in different things, the pork?
That is correct. We can make it into burrito, tacos, even enchiladas, just anything that you want to make it into, we can do it.
And you have this thing called the Diablo burrito. What's that?
Oh, yes, that's right. That's one of our popular burritos, too. It's a steak burrito with shrimp, fries, rice, and chipotle sauce to give it that spicy flavor.
And you use flour or corn tortillas?
For the burritos, we use the flour tortillas. And for the tacos, obviously, we use corn, or we can do flour as well.
So soft or crispy tacos are possible?
Yes, and also our crunchy tacos, the shells are homemade. Those we make them here from scratch as well. We don't use any of the store-bought taco shells.
I'm a big fan of beans at Mexican restaurants. How do you make your beans?
So we use the pinto beans. Nothing's store-bought again. Nothing's canned. Everything's fresh. So we start from, boiling them. We have whole beans and the refried beans as well.
Let's talk about what it's like to run this business. You said that your family is involved. How many family members are involved in these two businesses?
Well, it's just my brother, his wife, myself, and my wife. We all try to put a little part of our time to make everything run well.
Is it hard to run a family business?
It is. You have to be away from home a lot. Our shift doesn't end once you leave the restaurant. You're always on call. So it's a little hard, especially having a family. You just have to be there all the time.
But there must be some rewards in working with your family as well.
Yeah, working with the family is great. It keeps us united. As of right now, my wife is helping me out a lot in my Ankeny location, where we don't have to be away from each other a lot, because we put a lot of hard work in there. And we can meet in the middle where we can try to make things run smoother rather than someone doing it by itself.
So you and I think you said your brother both worked in Abelardo's before you decided to start your own.
We were working in the Omaha location, and that was their first location that Abelardo's opened.
And how did you then come to be in Ames?
Well, I moved out of state. I moved to northern Indiana. I worked there for about 2 years in a duck factory when I got a call from Abel, the franchisor. And he was selling his location in Ankeny. And he liked the way I worked back then. And so he gave me that big opportunity. And I didn't even think about it. I just came here, saw the restaurant, and we agreed on it.
That's really wonderful that he saw something in you that you could handle running a business like this, and he reached out to you.
Yeah, that was I was surprised. I was really grateful for that, or for him giving me that opportunity. Like I said, I mean, I wasn't working at the time for him, and yeah, he decided to give me a call, and which I really appreciate.
And your family comes originally from Mexico. What part of Mexico?
I was born in Mexico. I grew up, or I was there for 9 years. After that, we moved to California, and that's where I was most of my life. I was there for about 12 years, then moved around to Reno, Nevada, to Nebraska, ended up in northern Indiana, and well, now I'm here in Iowa.
And how are you finding it in Iowa? Is there a good customer base and support for your restaurant?
There's a lot of support from the people here in Iowa. It's just great. We see a lot of support from our customers, especially here in the Ames location. A lot of students, and they spread the word on us. They just give us so many good things to keep working for.
And do you have a lot of regulars, people who come in frequently?
Oh, yes. Most of our customers are regulars. We have an employee. Her name is Hannah. She's just very lovely with the customers. And a lot of customers come and visit her, and they know her by name. And she knows most of the customers by name as well. So that tells us a lot that we do have a lot of regular customers here in the Ames location.
Yeah, so you're able to make that connection with them as people, not just as customers.
Yeah, we try to keep that connection. I mean, our cashiers are very friendly with the customers. A lot of the college students, like I said, they know our cashiers by name, and the cashiers know their customers by name. So that we see something in there. We see a big connection, and we try to keep it that way all the time.
And it's interesting, as we're sitting here in the restaurant, it's lovely. The sun's shining in the window, and it is fast food in the sense that you go to the counter and order, but then when you sit down, you feel like you're in kind of a sit-down restaurant.
Yeah, out of all the avalados, we're the only ones that do that, because we want to make the customer feel as if it was a full-service restaurant, and, you know, to have that comfort of sitting and not having to get up. We want to make them feel like they're home.
People place their order, but then you bring the order to their table?
Yeah, we bring it out all the time. So the customer comes in, they order, they want to grab some sauce, and then they can sit down, and our cashiers will bring out the food to their table.
And because this was a former Long John Silver's location, there was a drive-in window, and you made the decision to keep that, so people can also get their food through the drive-in?
Yeah. Both locations have the drive-through window. We try to make it faster for those people that have children or just don't have the time to get off the car and come in and order. We have that advantage that they can just go through the window and pick up their food a little faster.
So you're doing pretty well. So what would you say is the secret of your success?
Our customers. I guess our customers have been very loyal. They've been supporting us. And like I said, we try to do things the right way, a way that the customer can be pleased and they can keep coming back.
What plans do you have for improvement or change in the future?
Right now we want to work on the locations. We want to make them look a little better. Like I said, it was an old building, Long John Silver's. And they do need a lot of work, so we're working on them right now, trying to reupholster the boots and give it a little more color to it. And after that, we're probably going to expand into another location.
So you're going to look for another place to start one or to buy one that's in existence?
There's a possibility that we might open another location in the Des Moines area by the airport. We're discussing that, and that one would be a brand new building.
So many times when a business leaves, like Long John Silver or KFC down the street leaves, and the building just sits empty. It's not good for the community. It's not good for the city. So it's really great that you were able to repurpose and revitalize these two older buildings.
Yeah, that's the concept of Avelados is to use the buildings that were used in other chains. And we put a lot of work in them to try to make it work, and also to be part of the community, not to just go into invest in new properties. We rather use the buildings that are already recentered and you know, people are used to.
And your other employees, do they tend to work with you for quite a while?
Most of our employees have been working with us since we opened. They've stayed with us, and I guess that's one of the keys for us doing well, because we have the same employees. They seem happy here, and they work great.
What are your hours at this location?
This location, we're open from 7 a.m. To 2 a.m. from Sunday through Thursday, and on Friday and Saturday, we're open from 7 to 4 in the morning.
Yeah, I've heard that this is kind of a late night place to come for students or other people to get some food late at night.
Yeah, since we're close to campus, I know there's a lot of students that go out or like to party, and there's hardly anything open at that time. So we decided to extend our hours to 4 in the morning. That way they, on their way home or if they want to stop and grab something to eat, you know, we're here for them.
Yeah, that there are not many places open at that hour in Ames. Have you had any problems late at night? People tend to drink, or have there been any problems like that?
We've never had an issue with the customers or the students. I mean, they just seem to be very calm. They're really great even when they're drunk. So it's in overall, we've never had a problem.
They're just hungry.
Yep, that's how they are.
Are the hours similar in Ankeny? Do you stay open that late?
No, in 1980, our hours are different. We're open from 9 a.m. To midnight. From Sunday through Thursday, Fridays and Saturdays, we're open from 9 to 3 in the morning.
If you think about where your family came from in Mexico, the area, because I know there's different cuisines and different recipes in different parts of Mexico, but if you think about where your family is from, would you say this food is similar to that?
No, this type of menu comes from northern Mexico. So it's a little different than what we're used to. I was born in San Luis Potosí, which is the center of Mexico. So this is a little different than what my family's used to. But the menu comes from the northern part of Mexico and the southern part of the United States. So this is more of a Tex-Mex, mix of a Tex-Mex and the Mexican style.
And you have a couple different kinds of meats that are unusual that you won't find in all fast food Mexican restaurants. Could you tell us about those?
Yeah, we have the steak. We have our fish burritos, which is I guess not a lot of Mexican restaurants have those. We have the adobada, which is marinated pork. We have our carnitas, our shredded pork. We have the pollo asado, grilled chicken. That one's really, really good. And ground beef, that's our most popular meat for our chimichangas, our tacos, and burritos.
You look very young to be an entrepreneur and a restaurateur like this.
Yeah, I started when I was 24 years old. I was able to buy into the franchise when I was just 24. Right now, I just turned 28. I'm the youngest of the family. I had one of my other brothers working here, too. And the one that manages the Ankeny location, he's also young. He's very young as well. So we were able to get into all this at a very young age.
I always have the idea that it takes a lot of courage to start your own business because, you know, you hear so much about restaurants failing and how hard it is to keep your own business going. But you seem to be rolling right along.
It's a little scary at the beginning. Obviously, everybody's is afraid to fail. Fortunately, we were able to make it work. Yeah, there's that fear of not having what it's needed to run a restaurant, or the attitude or the passion to do it. And you know, working as a family, I think that's what helped us.
So you felt like you weren't in it alone.
No, I had a lot of support from my other brothers, and they're very supportive in overall.
And does the franchise also provide support?
They do. For the startup, they help us financially. They try to do as much as they can for us as well, for us to make it work.
How many are there in Iowa? Do you know?
There's a total of 6 in the Des Moines area, and there's about 10 or 12 in the Omaha area.
So if somebody hasn't been to one and they're thinking, oh, I need to go try this place, what would you tell them to order? What would you order if you were coming here to eat?
Well, that's a little hard. Everybody has a different taste, but you know, there's something for everybody. My favorite burrito is the California burrito, which is similar to the Diablo. It has the steak, French fries, cheese, and pico de gallo. It's all cooked together. That's one of my favorite burritos to recommend. The mixed fajitas. You got chicken, steak, and shrimp all in one plate. We have 24 combinations, and we have over 20 burritos to choose from. There's something for everybody in here.
You have some special drinks as well that people can get to go with their meals?
We have the fountain drinks, but we have our horchata, which is a rice and cinnamon drink, Jamaica, and the pineapple drink. We also have jarritos. Not a lot of Mexican restaurants have those. And we also have the bottled Cokes, the glass bottle Cokes, which are rare in some restaurants.
And the jarritas are also in bottles?
Yes, they're glass bottle drinks. They're all made with 100% sugar, a little different than like a regular fountain drink.
So it's not made with corn syrup, in other words. And these are from Mexico?
Yes, they are. And we have over 8 flavors of those.
Okay, so people can try one of those to go with their meal if they haven't had one. Well, thank you very much for talking with us. I think that you've given us a great picture of
Abelardo's Mexican food.
That was Eleazar Flores, who, with several family members, owns and manages two Abelardo's Mexican restaurants, one in Ames and another in Ankeny. Eleazar said that their building on Lincoln Way had been empty for quite a while before they moved in, and that it was in very bad shape with water damage and some serious problems. They're making a lot of improvements, and it looks great already, but customers can expect to see even more improvements in the future. It sounds like they have many loyal customers and are here to stay as part of the Ames community. And one thing Eleazar said he forgot to mention is that on their menu, they also have a number of different breakfast burritos, which are available all the time.
Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Prospero año y felicidad. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Prospero año y felicidad. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas from the bottom of my heart.
That was Feliz Navidad by Jose Feliciano, and this is Local Talk on KHOI. We are in the midst of our fall membership drive, and we're about halfway to our goal of $40,000. So if you haven't donated yet, what are you waiting for? Just do it right now. The easiest way is to go to our website, khoifm.org, and look for the donate button. Dustin Ingram is with us now, and he is the Director of Community and Economic Development Outreach with the Ames Chamber of Commerce.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here today.
Thanks for coming in. And your work is in the area of economic development, specifically with some of the smaller towns here in Story County, particularly towns under 2,000 people. Maybe you could start by telling us what those towns are.
Sure. So the Ames Economic Development Commission is able to provide economic and community development services to, like you said, communities with under 2,000 people or fewer. So those communities include, and this is quite a list here, but it's Gilbert, Roland, McCallsburg, Zering Collins, Cambridge Maxwell, Slater Kelly, and Colo.
And are there unincorporated areas in the county that fall outside of those towns?
Right. So we are able to provide those services to unincorporated communities or areas, villages, so forth, in Story County. But most of the work's going to be through those cities because those are the ones that, you know, are calling for the services and most need them.
So you contract with the county to do this? And so your focus is on Story County?
Correct. That's correct.
And what kinds of services do you provide?
Right. So it's anything from, like I said, community development's included in this, but economic development. So the economic development side would mostly be business recruitment and retention and that kind of thing. But we also work a lot with city councils on projects just that they have on their minds for their towns. Lots of small town revitalization. That's what we're seeing in some of our smaller communities. For instance, Collins, Iowa recently opened a wellness center in their downtown, which is really impressive for a community of just over 500 residents, but has a high utilization there with the equipment. They actually draw people from outside the community. Just another shout out here to Zering. They opened a medical clinic recently, so that will be an economic development project. And that medical clinic's actually through Hanson Family Hospital right in their downtown. And then we're working on a lot of downtown renovations and redevelopment. So we're looking at older properties and trying to rehab those properties for commercial development on the first floor, housing on the second floor. That's the most desirable way because you can create that market base of residents and businesses.
So how do you work with these communities then? How do you support those efforts, whether it's community development or economic development?
Right. So a lot of that's going to be technical assistance. So just bringing the expertise to the table and letting them lean on us, rely on us if they need that help. But also just having networks and knowing where to look for opportunities. So for instance, in Cambridge, we just last week submitted a community catalyst grant that's through the Iowa Economic Development Authority's Downtown Resource Center. That grant's for $100,000. And so we brought that grant to their knowledge and that kind of thing. And then worked with many different players. Everyone's hands were on deck there to submit that grant application.
You mentioned community development and economic development. What's the difference and what's the overlap between the two?
Right. Well, there's a lot of overlap. I would say the distinction would be when you're looking at economic development, you're thinking about job creation and revenue growth for the cities and anywhere where the property tax would go to with new, creation of new industry and that kind of thing or new business. With community development, you're mostly looking at quality of life, which is so critical in today's environment for our small towns, not only to be competitive, but to provide the services and to provide the amenities that our communities' residents need to live a happy life, to put it simply.
Why is there a need for this particular work with small towns?
Yeah. So in Iowa, of course, everyone's heard about the small town decline and that kind of thing. It is just tougher for small communities these days. In the past, it was a bit easier when you didn't have to focus on things like business recruitment as much and where you had people living in your communities. But as you know, in recent years or recent decades, we've had population decline and brain drain and that kind of thing. And it doesn't mean that communities have to decline or anything, but you do have to engage with the local leaders. You have to develop that informal leadership. And if you focus on quality of life initiatives, what we found is that communities tend to fare a bit better. And in the end of the day, you still have people living in those towns and you still have folks that need those services, kids who still need to go to school. And so it's critical that we make sure that their lives are as good as can be in those places.
Who do you work with in the towns? Do you work with the city councils or other kinds of community groups or associations?
Yeah, it totally ranges. I go to a lot of city council meetings. And then at those meetings, you find out some of the problems, or maybe they think of you for assistance right there on the spot. But I've worked with everyone from city council members, mayors, and that kind of thing, all the way to people on a pool committee in the city of Roland. So they're looking at, renovating one of their older pools so they can keep that quality of life amenity in their community. And so they've relied on us for assistance in terms of networks and opportunities to fund a project of that size.
Is it possible for you to help small towns work together on particular projects, or is it more individual projects for specific towns?
It seems to me that our office is kind of a conduit for those communities to work together because, if you're showing up at the different communities here that I've listed, all of them actually, you're able to talk about projects that were successful in some communities and maybe others are having the same problems. Problems tend to not be unique when they're especially with like downtown revitalization or business recruitment. We share these problems. And so having someone, show their face at a meeting and talk about the successes in our other communities, that does help the other towns think more regionally, I would say.
In general, what kind of economic development do you see? How do you predict for the future of these small towns?
It depends on where you're at. I think in Story County, we obviously benefit from the university and the competitive advantages that we have here in Ames. For instance, we're seeing biotechnology companies take an interest in some of our small towns like Slater. Grosswind Technologies is one of those companies. It's an Ames-based startup and algae-based water treatment. So they provide a water treatment solution. And they're looking at different municipalities, but they have an interest here because they're from here and staying here and that kind of thing. So we've seen that they have an interest in office space in some of our communities as well as water treatment. And so the city of Slater has actually approved resolutions to go forward on negotiations about that kind of thing. But and all of that's public knowledge. You can check the minutes for that in the Slater City Council. But that shows that we're playing on our competitive advantages.
If some of these small towns are trying to attract businesses or different services there, what kinds of incentives do they often offer, if any?
You know, some of them are more reluctant than others to offer incentives. Some of them obviously offer the tax abatement program, which may be familiar to you, and Ames, I think, has one as well. But it just depends on the community, on the business's needs. And if you are recruiting a business, sometimes the incentives aren't actually the first thing they're looking at. They want to make sure their site is correct, right, and their building is appropriate for what they need, that they can attract that workforce to the community. And so there are lots of different factors that go involved.
You mentioned a couple examples of projects that are going on now, the new wellness center in Collins. What are some other examples of projects that are either going on or just recently done or in the works?
Sure. So in Zeering, they recently received a community catalyst grant of $100,000. That was just the previous year for their old bank building. And again, that was an example where you had local leaders and informal leaders in the community just put all of their effort into submitting a successful grant application. And we're seeing the renovation of that building. And again, that's going to be commercial on the bottom floor and housing on the upper story. Also in Zeering, the medical clinic that I mentioned, that may have been the one that I talked about earlier. So that medical clinic actually had 70 folks call in prior to opening day to book appointments. And so that's demonstrating a need in that community for an essential service like medical services. And we're thrilled and happy to see our communities take advantage of that kind of opportunity.
I know some towns in central Iowa, because of industries and businesses that are in them, have experienced demographic shifts where they have a lot more immigrants and moving to them work in businesses. Is that impacting any of these small towns?
You know, it may be. I haven't actually checked the statistics on the minority population of those communities, but I will say that workforce is an issue here in Story County. We do know that we have one of the, and most sometimes the lowest unemployment rate in the entire country as a city, and that Story County also has that incredibly low unemployment rate. And so when we think about workforce, you know, we do need the workers that are qualified to fill these jobs that are in these companies that are hiring, that are looking for qualified employees. We need those people here for those types of vacancies.
I know that the balance between quality of life and economic growth is always an issue in trying to bring those two into some kind of balance. And last week we had a lot of coverage on CFOs, confined feeding operations that are proposed for, in this case, Nevada, which is not one of your towns. So my question is, how do you help towns find that balance between economic growth, but which may negatively impact the quality of life in those areas?
Yeah, that's an age-old question, right? We need the jobs and we need the economic growth, but also keeping the quality of life. Mostly in the rural communities, we're seeing, you know, more mom-and-pop type growth and that kind of thing in our smaller communities. And so I don't really see a huge sacrifice in quality of life in what we're doing in our rural communities. But at the end of the day, it's kind of a chicken and egg question, too, in terms of what comes first, job creation or quality of life. And we're finding that in most small communities, if they have a focus on quality of life, that is going to be what drives their economy going forward for a rural community specifically.
If someone, say, moves to the area and they have the option of living in Ames or one of the surrounding smaller communities, what would attract them to the smaller town as opposed to Ames?
I think lower housing costs. If you enjoy kind of a pleasant, more rural living, that kind of thing, then you would be attracted to a rural community. And most folks don't think of that when they're looking at Story County. If they're thinking about moving here, a lot of times it is Ames. But in a place like Cambridge, for instance, you still have that proximity to those regional markets, those larger cities and metropolitan areas. You're still pretty close to I-35. And so your connectivity doesn't really alter all that much, even in some of our smaller communities. But I think, you know, that there are people who do prefer a slower pace of life and that kind of thing. And they're looking at our smaller communities.
Do the communities kind of advertise themselves to attract people to them?
Some more than others, and part of our responsibilities would be to market those communities.
Okay, to assist with that.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why did you decide on the cutoff of 2,000? Why not 3,000? Because, for example, I noticed Huxley wasn't on your list, but I think of that as a small town, but I guess that must be over 2,000.
Right. So I wasn't there for the negotiations in terms of which communities were classified as 2,000 or fewer. But we do have, you know, differences in economies in places like Huxley and Nevada, as well as Story City. There's a bit more industry in those communities. But with those communities, we also do have contracts with places like Huxley. So we provide economic development services for other towns in the county as well.
Okay.
Those are just separate from what we do in the county.
Okay. Just not through this small town focused project.
Right. And what you touched on earlier with the regional partnerships, I think that's also a benefit of having kind of the ability to provide those services to other communities of a bit larger size in the county as well, because we can connect those to everyone else.
Another topic that seems to be of concern and interest in the area is affordable housing. Is that something that gets talked about and thought of in terms of development within these small towns?
Yeah, I think it does get talked about, and each community is going to be, you know, have more nuanced needs in terms of housing. Sometimes it may be that you need housing for a specific type or a specific age of population or a demographic. And so we have to be sensitive to that, but also in our communities, you know, some of them may have a declining quality housing stock, and so they just may have older housing. And we do see, like, places in Collins, for instance, who are looking at more infill development projects and, you know, and making sure that the housing stock they do have is not declining in quality. And I'll add that those projects in the downtowns that I mentioned, when you're talking about two or three housing units in a place like, you know, Cambridge, mm-hmm. That's a big chunk of their housing in a way. And so to have that immediately come online is a big plus for those towns.
Tell us a little bit about your background and how you got interested in this particular issue.
Sure. So I am from Elberton, Georgia. I'm not a native born Iowan. But yeah, I was from a small town in Georgia, northeast Georgia, just south of the Appalachian Mountains. And similar problems that other rural communities face, my town face. For instance, you know, closing storefronts and population decline, economic restructuring and shifts in industry, loss of a labor force, all of that stuff. And so that really motivated me to develop an interest in community betterment and looking holistically at the ways that we can improve our rural communities and build on their assets rather than get stuck in thinking about all the negatives that you could imagine. And so I went to undergraduate school. I got my bachelor's degree at Piedmont College in northeast Georgia up in the mountains. And then I decided that I wanted to study specifically rural communities. And I looked at different city planning programs throughout the country and found that there were faculty here at Iowa State University. So I actually attended here for graduate school.
Oh, and then you stayed.
That's correct. And then there was an opportunity in Hardin County, actually, which I think your coverage extends to, but for ACLEI, I was Economic Development Director. And so I served in that position for a bit as well. And we worked on similar issues, right? Housing, business recruitment and retention and expansion projects, downtown betterment and so forth.
For our listeners maybe who tend to be stuck in Ames a lot, not stuck, but they stay in Ames, tell us one thing that we should get out of Ames and go see or do in a small town in Story County.
Yeah, I think, and a lot of you may have already have seen this, but the Reed and Island Corner is really interesting to me because that's kind of a historic landmark there in Colo, right at the junction of Jefferson Highway and Lincoln Highway. And sometimes we underappreciate those historical assets in our communities, but that's actually a huge deal to have here in Colo.
Okay, so that's one thing that if we folks who live in Ames haven't gotten out to do, maybe we should do that. I wanted to give a shout out also to Susan Franzen, who on our Wednesday local talk show covers small towns in Iowa, not just under 2,000, but she covers the smaller towns in central Iowa specifically. Susan gave me some ideas of questions I should ask you. So
great.
Shout out to Susan and listen to her show on Wednesday. Anything else, last minute things you want to tell us about the work that you're doing?
You know, I would just say it's always a pleasure to advocate for the rural communities in Story County, and I thank you for giving me that opportunity today.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Dustin Ingram, the Director of Community and Economic Development Outreach with the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Local Talk brings you these monthly visits by the Chamber of Commerce, as well as other groups such as the Ames Convention and Visitors Bureau, the Office of Sustainability, the Ames History Center, and several more. If you value these and all that we bring to you, why not become a member of KHOI or make a donation today? Think of all that you learn by listening to Local Talk and donate to KHOI now. Go to khoifm.org and look for the donate button. This is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Gail Seiler. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can listen to today's show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered by Cynthia McClure. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. We also heard Skating by the Vince Guaraldi Sextet and Feliz Navidad by Jose Feliciano. Remember, your participation as an audience and supporter is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thank you for listening and see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. We encourage you to shop local this holiday season. You can support Ames' growth while enjoying a wide array of local shopping and dining experiences that Ames independent businesses have to offer. From the Ames Chamber of Commerce, happy holidays! Let's shop local and grow Ames.